Introduce David B. Thank you.
Okay. My name is David and I'm an alcoholic. You know, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous this time by a member of the staff in USP Lompoc Federal Penitentiary. His name was Lee Carroll. Lee C. Yeah, sorry for that, Lee. And he used to give us he was practicing to give archival talks, right, for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, out in the real world, right? And he would sit us all down, the members of the group in there, and tell us about, you know, he would practice on us. He would give us his archival talk, you know. And he was horrible. Man, we would sit there rolling our eyes, and then all of a sudden, anytime he spoke about H and I, he got our attention, because H and I was saving our lives at the moment. We were in the middle of for me and for a lot of other guys that I'm still in contact with, it was the most important time of my life. You know, I was in the best possible place I could be, the worst federal penitentiary on the West Coast. And it was exactly where God intended me to be. And he talked about, and Lee would talk about, Warden Duffy, you know, in San Quentin, that opened the prisons and requested AA to come in and share with the inmates in there. And he told us about Jack Prose, you know, that one of the first guys in there, you know, and he really got my attention then, because I was into Hatchby Prison, and Jack Prose came up and talked to us at the end of his life, or towards the end of his life. And, you know, 50-something years of sobriety, and, you know, one of the founders of official H&I, you know, and it was just, you know, there's times in my life when I look back and you know, it's like the horror, or it's oh my God, you know, oh my God, because I could see the finger of God working in my life at those certain times, and they become like semi-legendary or mythical in my mind, and I just get so grateful that I have memories like that now, you know. And I got to tell you, the memories that I have that are like that now are 98% thanks to H&I and thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the blueprint of living of AA and the 12 steps and strong sponsorship, fearless and searching, man, as the theme of this conference is, it constructed a new man inside me, and I am so grateful. And before I really get started, this is your fourth annual convention. I can hardly believe it. You know, I've only been free for 3 years, but I've been going to every convention in all Southern California, because it's this mana for me. It's this, you know, it charges me up, and just I get to feel part of. Okay. Dave Boyd never was a part of anything in my life, right? And I wasn't even pertinent in my life. But I've never seen a conference like this. I mean, you guys are so organized, and you are so professional, and you're so welcoming, and I want to thank my host Vince. He's been very, he tied my tie for me. I was never in a place in my life where they taught me how to teach Thai ties, so, you know, I'm still lacking in a lot of things in this world, but that's fine, you know. My greatest source of strength is my ability to ask for help, you know. That's what AA has taught me, so. You guys have given me a lot of help here today and yesterday, and you kept, Mike asked me to speak here 14 months ago, right? And I'm like, 07, October 07, you sure you don't mean, you know, 2 months from now? And he goes, no, 07, you know, we like to do it this way, you know. And I'm like, oh, you like to keep us sober for a long period of time. I got a commitment. I can't. You won't ask me to speak if I drink, will you? And so this conference has kept me sober for the last 14 months. It's wonderful. And I have to find a new commitment here real quick. But I would name people, but I was talking with you before the meeting. I don't know where memory went. It's like the fog is supposed to lift after a certain amount of years. August 30th, 1997 is my sobriety date, I'm still waiting for the fog to lift. You know, you tell me your name, and I forgot it. And within that, as soon as the resonance of your voice is gone, your name's gone with it. So, you know, I'm challenged in that way. I'm the son of a professor of mathematical anthropology. My dad opened up the University of California at Irvine in 65, and we moved out from Michigan. I don't remember much of Michigan, but I remember snow. Like I'd have to look up over my head to see over the snow, but of course I was smaller than the table. But I remember snow, and I remember a birthday party where my mom invited all the kids in the neighborhood, and I knew them all, you know, but I was the focus of attention, you know. It was all about me, you know. Now, at certain times now in my life, I'm with that. I'm with that right now. You know, it's all about me right now. I'm up here speaking. Back then, I just lost it, you know, and I did what I do best. I went and ran and hid. And you know, I've been running and hiding ever since. You know, ever since I ran and hid, and then I snuck back to the windows and I looked in, and they were eating my cake and playing with my presents. You know, I'm on the outside looking in from one of my very first memories. You know, and you know, looking back on my childhood, which I did okay. You know, I wasn't committing armed robberies as a, you know, 8-9 year old. So I mean, I did all right. I wasn't breaking major laws at the time. I was going to school. I had a good brain, you know, inherited. And but this, I realized that, you know, the problem was with David Boyd at an early age is a physics problem. You know, I'm air conditioned refrigeration guy. I went to school for that, and you know, and I'm an electrician. But I found out in my schooling that pressure at sea level is 14.7 psi pounds per square inch, and so the pressure inside us as human beings is pretty much the same as, you know, I mean, that's the way we're geared at, is 14.7 to equalize the pressures. Well, I was about a good 10 to 15 PSI more on the inside, you know, and I was one of the tensest, most wound up kids you could, I mean, just ready to explode at any moment. And everything was a big deal. I heard a woman when I got out in my new home group from Laguna Beach, she used to talk about excruciating sense of self-consciousness, you know, and I went, that's what it was. That's what it was. I was excruciating self-conscious, and it was awful. I remember asking a girl to, you know, in fourth, fifth grade or whatever, you know, you never even talked to this girl, but you saw her across the kindergarten yard or whatever, and I asked, you know, sent a little note, you know, would you go steady with me, right? This girl sat on that note for a week. You know, for a week. You know, and I'm, you know, that just ready to go. I wanted to jump in a hole somewhere, you know, because I'd committed myself. I was vulnerable. Of course, it was no. It was the answer at the end of the week, you know. First resentment. No. But I did okay in sports, although I was a little clumsy. But baseball, I was good at baseball, you know. And in the middle of my little league career, at age 12, I got on the back of someone's motorcycle, and a nylon rope wrapped around my hand, and we're riding along, and a loop came off, and it got wound up in the chain in the sprocket, that loop, and jerking all the loops off my hand. But as the last loop came off my hand, went into the chain and sprocket, and lopped off the end of my thumb. So little league career's over, you know, it's done. So I jumped into school real hard, you know, and I was on the dean's list in seventh grade. You know, I was my father's son. They skipped me ahead to the next grade's math class. You know, really my father's son, right? And I remember, you know, I've got the best tutor in the world. You know, waiting at home. I got dad waiting at home. Poor dad, you know. How can you teach somebody something that if he doesn't understand it instantly is throwing a rage, you know, crying and shrieking, and I was wound up too tight, and if I didn't understand it right away internally, I was a stupid kid, you know. I'm stupid. I'll never match up to dad. I'll never be able to measure up to my parents. You know, that was basically what I I don't ever remember thinking that consciously, but once again, I have done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have looked at the causes and conditions of why would somebody do those things? You know, unless they're insane, why would somebody end up doing the things that I do? You know, and my parents, I heard somebody share this the other day. They said, you know what, that phrase that they did the best they could with what they had, you know. And he just wanted to go, screw that, you know, screw that. Because it wasn't enough, you know. Well, who was it enough for? I mean, I haven't ever met anybody that truly believed and convinced me that their parents were perfect. You know, it doesn't happen, you know. My parents were going through their own stuff at the time. My dad got sober in 68. He was drinking alcoholically, and he got sober, and we hung out at Dr. Paul's house. My mom was in Al-Anon. My dad was AA mover and shaker. I mean, he jumped into AA in Laguna Beach area, you know, and he knew Chuck C. And my mom was friends with Elsa, and I'm going. Me and my sister are going to Alateen, and we're just this wonderful little AA family. And my dad. What's happening inside me I don't know what could have stopped it. I was like a juggernaut even back then. You know, I was headed full force for an alcoholic lifestyle. You know, and there's nothing that would have stopped that, man. I don't, if I had the perfect parents, doesn't matter. They're not God, and they're not a cure for alcoholism. I am my dad's, he's not an alcoholic. 72, 73, he started drinking again as a normal person drinks, and he's one of those people you have our hats off to. You know, I haven't seen him drunk in 35 whatever plus years since then. You know, he's not. You know. But me and my sister and my mom, we don't have an excuse to get help for our problems anymore. You know, and so I pretty much took over from my dad at that age. In 1972, I in between class, somewhere around right before Christmas, I was introduced to alcohol and outside issues and in Laguna Beach at the time it was Timothy Leary had just got kicked out of town or hauled away out of town or rather, you know, and it was, you know, it was peace, love, tune in, turn on, drop out, and I just seized on that. Yeah, you know, Vietnam's going on. That's a perfect excuse, you know, to give the finger to authority and of any type in my life. And I went from the dean's list to in order to get an F, you have to actually attend class. So I couldn't even qualify for an F because I was gone. I was gone from the instant. I'd found the thing for me to run with that gave me wings, and I was just gone. You know, I was the truant officer's main objective in the town of Laguna Beach, and within, you know, a couple months of for me drinking, an initial drink, I was the police officer's interest in the town of Laguna Beach, because as soon as I started drinking and doing outside things, I ended up in your house, you know, and helping myself to your things. And anything in the world that was not nailed down, it was mine, you know, and I don't know at the time. And for a good time, I was maybe in my early 20s, I believed that there was something inherently wrong with me. Had no idea it was called alcoholism. But I knew there was something inherently wrong with me. I thought it was just I didn't have a conscience. That's what it felt like, you know, because from my earliest memory, my mom was trying to instill in me character and morals and let me know how wrong it was, something I had done, you know, regardless of what it was. And I had no ability to show any feeling on that. You know, I'm sorry. As a kid, I didn't come out with this moral guide that when you do this wrong, you got to cry and show that you're sorry. You know, you got to really feel it and let everybody know how sorry you are. I would just clam up, you know, and just look at, you know. And my mom would drive on me until I showed something. And usually, I showed it by you know, the spring would snap. You know, and I would just go overboard and scream and, you know, hit my head into the walls or something, you know. So that's what was wrong with me, right? I forgot to time myself. You might be here for a long time, sorry. But I was, I was messed up, you know. I was just messed up, I heard Clancy speak the other day in Laguna for the first time live. You know, I listened to his speaker tapes in prison for years. I heard him describe alcoholism as opposed to the alcoholic or the hard drinker. And he described me better than anybody I've ever heard. You know, he described the problem, because it was when I found alcohol, that pressure just went right back down. You know, that internal thing, I just want to explode, and I can't stand myself, and I can't stand you, and nothing's right. You know, I've got this measuring stick in me, man, that everything in the world, I put up against the print of that, and everything falls short, and everything bothers me. Every time it falls short, it bothers me. I know what that is now, or in my belief now what that is that's the signature of God. You know, that's like, this is perfection, and this is only me. This is proof that I'm here, because there's nothing in the world that from me, from you, from any of us, from the world in general, that's perfect. So that's how I choose to look at it now. But in that gap between what with the perfection and what we can reach, you know, there's two things in there. My ego will live in there, or my faith will live in there. And for all my life, my ego ran in there, the fear that I'm never going to be enough. You're never going to be enough, and it's all for naught. And there's no purpose, and there's no dignity, and there's no meaning. It all ends in a grave somewhere, you know. And I'm listening to the body count and the news at night, and during the war, and I just seized on all that to just build it inside me. This little thing that says screw everything, you know, screw it. The Texas Serenity Prayer I always heard was, well, F it, you know, the short, and that's how I live my life. I was in every juvenile institution that Orange County has to offer. I was in every single one of them, you know, and inside those places, you know, I'm meeting kids from Santa Ana, you know, and I'm meeting kids from, you know, the various, you know, they're not like Laguna Beach kids. I didn't ever meet any homeboys from Laguna Beach in those places, man. I was the only one, you know, and coming from where I come from and with what I mean, I wasn't stupid. I was just really, really misguided and did stupid things. But what that allowed me to do was feel better than them, you know. And so I was better than them on the inside, and I was worse than all the rest of you when I got on the outside. You know, there was no place where I was the same as, you know, my whole life. I don't remember any place like that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we'll jump forward. It was like, okay, I got this history. This is a sick. I mean, I've got written proof, and it's in all kind of government agency archives and all stuff. How bad I am! It's like, yeah, all the alcoholism that we suffer from, and all those feelings, and all that just that's on the inside. I put it on the outside so they could arrest me for it. You know, I don't know. It was when I came in, it was like, oh, Mike, you did what? Oh, come on in. We love you, man. We love you. You know, it seems like the worse you are in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more they love you. And it's, you know, it's custom built for me. Because, you know, after all those years and in all those places I was at, I don't think it's purposely designed that way, but maybe it is. I mean, it was, you know, the very name penitentiary means, you know, they want to make you penitent, and it's somewhere there's got to be the same root word as punishment somewhere in there, right? But it was, what it did is made me, I mean, those places make you feel small, you know. The whole place is geared to break you down as a human being, and society has told you from the judge and the jury on down that, you know, you're a criminal. You know, you're a criminal, you know. And God, guys in there, they take this sick pride in that, right? I remember playing basketball, and I was really fearless on the basketball court, and I was really fearless with the, you know, the prison politics and stuff in there, because I come from Laguna Beach, man. And you're going to tell me I've got to hate a black man because I'm a white man. You know, that's basically how they do it in there. Or I'm going to hate a Cuban and a Mexican because I'm a white man, and they're not white, so they're no good. You know, and I know principles, you know, divide and conquer real well. I loved history, right? Man, that's, we are so busy fighting ourselves in there, you know, that the true nature of our problem, you know, it can't be addressed because we're so busy fighting each other in there. And I remember this guy knocking me down time and time again. He was a huge, huge Cuban guy, right? And every time he'd slam me to the ground, you know, I'd jump up and set a screen for the guy on my team to go around him, and he's trying to guard the guy, and I'd jump up and set a screen, and he'd throw his elbow right dead underneath my, you know, in my throat and slam me to the ground and then stand over me screaming, "I'm a criminal! I'm a criminal!" And I'm like, yeah, and how did I get here, man? How are we all in here? And why is that a brag? You know, why is that a brag? So, I mean, even in there, I couldn't buy into the romancing the stone of yeah, I'm a rebel and, you know, screw society and I should have been born 1,000 years ago with the Vikings and all. I mean, there's all this incredibly delusional thinking in there. I know you guys don't know anything about delusional thinking, but but we're really good at it in there. We're just tremendous, man. And I was as good as any of them, you know, because I thought I was better than them, you know. I thought I was better than them just because, you know, just where I came from, you know. I mean, I had no credit in that. It's just where I was born. But I ended up from every Orange County facility as a juvenile to I tried to join the military. You know, I graduated from the Youth Guidance Center in Orange County, and I took military tests, and I was, you know, I mean, they wanted me, you know. I was still had a couple brain cells left, and, you know, I really aced their tests, and they were going to send me to Russian language school, and the recruiter was all excited, you know, there's this bright kid that he's going to get into the military, and at that time in 78, there was, you're not getting into the military with a record, you know, it's not happening, you know, and I had multiple felonies already, you know, I didn't have any crimes of violence at the time, but I had, you know, probably 100, 150 burglaries, you know, as a kid, you know, that I'd been tried and arrested and convicted for. And you know, I was a one-man crime. Laguna Beach is only 15,000 people at the time, you know. I really hated being my parents and watching those headlights come out and go, oh, God, there's another street we can't drive on anymore. You know? I mean, my sister came up behind me in school. She's a couple years younger than me. And she would get into school, and this teacher would come up, and they say, oh, you're Laurel Boyd? You're not David Boyd's sister, are you? You know, and she would have the choice of lying or saying, yes, I am, and watching her teacher's eyes widen and step back from her, you know. I blew up the school bathroom in eighth grade. Well, it's not the school, it was the teacher's lounge bathroom, and they were in the lounge, and I had brought, my dad used to take us trips down to Mexico, and I'd brought back a little twine bomb, right? And it's a bunch of string and this thing with a fuse on. I didn't know what it was. You know what I mean? I mean, I knew it'd make a loud bang. I didn't know it'd blow a hole in the poured cement wall this big and knock the door off the hinges. And you know, as it's typical, Dave, my nickname is Crash. Okay, in typical Crash fashion, I'd set the cigarette time fuse on it. Me and my little bathroom gang friends were waiting around the corner, you know, all giggling, and it didn't go off. Right? So they're like, go check it. So I went and checked it, and I pulled the trash can back, and the fuse lit right as I pulled the trash can back. Oh, my God, and I hit the door. As the door closed behind me, it went off, and boom, and I'm coming out like this, and the principal's grabbing my arm. I mean, he's just right there, the vice principal. It's just right there, and I'm like, oh, man. You know, if I'd done that now, I'd be in Guantanamo on a Homeland Terrorist Act, I'm sure. Man. You know, I was very lucky, man, and so I went from YGC. I couldn't. My dad's a professor, right? So you can't get into the military unless you have five upstanding citizens from the community sign a recommendation for you. So my dad's got a whole bunch of professors to sign these things, right? So he gets these professors to do it, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to the military. They'll straighten my ass out, right? You know, I'd already done really well in the institutions. You know, once somebody's on me, over me in authority, I'm doing fine. You know, as soon as you take your eye off me, you know, God help you. So I figured I'd do okay in the military, right? And one of the professors didn't fill out the paperwork right, you know, and I'm like, God, man, how do you get to be a professor and you can't even fill out a waiver form, right, you know? And, but by the time we redid the whole thing, I'd broken out in a rash of felonies one more time, and I was sent to California Youth Authority. And, man, that was a rude awakening from a little beach kid, a little surfer rat beach kid from Laguna, man. YTS in 1978, 79 was just not the place to be. You know, I walked in and they've got more tattoos than any rock star you ever, rapper you've ever seen. You know, and they're kids, man. They're kids, but what they're in there to do is to make a reputation for themselves. You know, it just seemed like anybody you looked at, what are you looking at, man? What do you look? You want to, and you're in a fight. The next thing you know, and all you did was look at the guy. You know, it's it. You know, I walked in and once more in good crash fashion, this black guy started talking to me. You know, I'm talking to this guy and he's smoking a cigarette and I ain't had a cigarette in a little while. And he sees me looking at a cigarette and he says, "You want some of this?" I went, "Yeah, man." So he gives me a cigarette that he'd been smoking. I took a few puffs and then looked up and realized every white guy in the place was looking at me like they wanted to go right through me. Broke one of the unwritten laws. You know, you do not have contact with subhuman races, right? Oh my God, man, how the hell am I going to know that this is what they're thinking is in there, man? So nose broken and black eyes. And I mean, it's just didn't seem fair, right? One more time, things in life don't seem fair to me. That's my mom's main criticism of me anymore, because I tend to do the right thing now because I've been taught, but I still have this overactive sense of fairness, you know, and when I see things that aren't right, it's just so hard for me to keep my yap shut or to not internalize it and be bothered by it, you know, and I don't know, I get that from my mom. You know, she takes one to know one, so she's got the same thing going on. So I survived that anyway. I ended up testing high on their tests, and I went to Ventura College program up in Ventura, and I did okay there. And, you know, I got about a year and a half worth of credits, and I got out, and, you know, I'm not joining the military this time. Now I'm going to live in Oregon. Right? My grandmother moved up to Oregon, so now I'm doing the geographic, you know, and I'm moving to Oregon, man. There's none of my old friends, there's none of Laguna Beach Drug Society either. I should be fine, right? Man, I found within 3 days, I found in a town of 2,000 people, I found the 10 people probably that are just doing all kinds of bad things. You know, I don't know how it happened. It's just so fast, man. I found them. Within 2 months, I had to leave town because bad things were going to happen again. And so I came down to California one more time, and I ended up in Ontario. And I don't know how that happened, but I didn't have anything. I had, you know, very little going for me in life. You know, I think I had a backpack and a couple sets of clothes, right? A couple of different changes of clothes, and I ended up in Ontario with the same kind of crowd of people that I usually hang out with, and seemed like a good idea. I met this girl, right? And with everything being equal in my life at that time, it's, well, this is what, better in the military, get married, right? So I got married, you know? I mean, I was bringing so much to the table for this woman, you know? I mean, there's just no way a man of my caliber should escape her, you know? I mean, I was really, it was a real gift of self, you know? It's what oh my God. So I put this woman through hell, man. For the next 5 years, I put her through living hell. And you know, I'm in the process of making amends to her, right? And it's a long process. And she gave a timetable for the process, but I gave her this big drawing, right, of this lioness that kind of reminded me of her. You know, well, she's got a little more claws, but I was giving her this lioness. It reminded me of her, and it was, just, you know, I'm a fairly accomplished artist. I was in the Sawdust Festival this last summer in Laguna Beach, and I got to share my art and share myself with the world, you know, and it was a tremendous experience. But anyway, I'm giving her this drawing, and I said, "Well, this is, you know why I'm giving you this, Gina?" And she goes, "Why?" And I said, "Well, this is part of the amends process, man. I have to give of myself. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous says I have to do whatever it takes to make it right. you know, and you're going to let me know what else I need to do to make it right. She just looked at me. She goes, you know what? You're going to be making amends to me for the rest of your life. I can't argue, you know. I really can't argue, you know. We tried, you know. What I had been running for in Oregon came and arrested me again. And I got a 5-year sentence in the Oregon State Penitentiary. So now I got this brand new wife, and I got this brand new sentence. She was 17 years old. She moves up to Oregon and not knowing a soul in the town of Salem, rents a room, no car, no nothing. She rents a room and walks through the snow or rain or whatever it is every visiting day, which was 5 days a week, to come visit me in that place for almost 2 years. You know, now her life improved. She you know, got a car. My grandparents gave her a car, and she was working. She had a job, and she did all these things. And so when I got out to reward her and our brand new son, you know, we'd had a son, you know, to reward him, I abandoned both of them. You know, I abandoned both of them. You know, I hated her. I hated her, and I'll tell you why I hated her. I hated her because she loved me. She loved me so deeply it scared the crap out of me, and there was just no way in the world. There's just no way in the world that I knew who I was inside, man. And she was trying to send me a different message, and it scared me really badly. And you know, I was an alcoholic, and I was drinking, and I was throwing. You know, she grew up with older brothers, and every one of those brothers has scars on their body from her. Right, and this isn't justifying anything, but when we fought violently, you know, and I'd never had that experience before of having to defend myself from a woman, but I did, you know, I did, and I did too well, man, I did too well. I ended up in a fight with her where she grabbed my carpenter's pry bar and was beating me with this pry bar, and I had great big welts, bled all over, and I was grabbing her by the hair and bowling her around, and I ended up snapping, and there was one moment where she ceased being, and our kid's crying in the back room, and her little brother's trying to jump on my back, and it was a 12-year-old kid I'd been like dad to, and it was just one of the, you know, it was probably, after this thing, it was about as close as I ever come to suicide. I've not been a suicidal drunk because I'm too chicken shit, man. I'm too scared, you know. But I kicked her, you know, as just like I would. I for one instance, she ceased being the mother of my son and my wife and any of those things, and was as a threat to my life. You know, I saw all the blood running down my arm, and she's getting up with that pry bar again. And I kicked her and pinched a nerve in her neck. But she was okay. But what it looked like happened is I just broke her neck. So what by the actions of her body afterwards, when she went unconscious and she did the chicken, and I thought I broke her neck, you know, and I thought I'd killed her. And I took off, and I went to Mexico. It made sense to me. Along the way, I twice almost drove over a cliff. Twice, I came as close as I ever have to ending it. Almost drove over the cliff, and it turned out she was. I didn't, you know. And I sold the car, and I went into a outside issue craze and drinking the whole way, and I ended up getting in contact with my family, and they let me know that she was okay, and so just to make sure that everything was all right, I went back up there also to get my paycheck, which she had picked up from my boss, right, so I met her, and you know, she's got a neck brace on, but she's okay, and I'm supposed to sign the check over to her and my son, and I took the check, and I took off, you know. I was scum walking. You know, I was scum walking, man. So I went. I ended up almost killing a man in Laguna Beach. I was drunk, and he was drunk, and he was attracted to me, and he was huge, But I had a pistol. So, you know, I didn't kill him, but I hurt him really bad. I pistol whipped the guy, and I thought he was dead, you know. And I ended up with a 7-year sentence in Lompoc for that. They charged me with great bodily harm, assault with a deadly weapon, great bodily harm, grand theft, auto, armed robbery, and mayhem. You know, and they offered me a deal for 29 years. You know, and I went, no. And I had a good public defender, and he fought for me, and we, you know, we turned some tables on this poor guy, you know, legally, and I got a 7-year sentence. You know, and at that time in '85, you only did half that time. So I did 3.5 years for almost killing a man and taking his car and taking his money. Man, I've been a really, really lucky man. But I ended up in Soledad Penitentiary, you know, and I didn't get the message there. I didn't think I had a problem, you know. This is the professor's son, right? Professor's son, man. But I don't have a problem. You know, a series of bad breaks and unfortunate coincidences, and I still do what my sponsor talks about, man. I mean, I did then. I'm still really able to just look at, you know, well, if they hadn't done that, I wouldn't have done this, man. So it's not my fault. It's their fault, you know. I never could point the finger at me, you know, and take personal responsibility for my life. That was just wasn't possible. You know, I don't blame myself for that anymore. It just wasn't possible for me and my alcoholism at that time. You know, the ability for self-reflection was just not there. You know, it's in the nature of my disease. I cannot self-reflect unless the pain of the situation where I put myself in finally overrides my ego. And I have to face the man in the mirror, man. And God, it took a lot of years for that. This is my next. Okay, I'm not even going to go into Soledad because I'll be here too long. But just enough to tell you that those guys in there. By this point, and I'm not using in there. I'm not drinking, and I'm not using outside issues, and I'm not doing anything, but just, you know, working out. And I'm big as a house, and I'm nobody can stand me. You know, the multiple armed robbers and the murderers and the lifers and everything just cannot stand. Get away from us, you know. I'm this smart guy, right? I'm this college professor's son, man, and you know, I can't even find friends in there. You know, I finally had somebody come and tell me, look, man, you know what? If you don't change your actions if you don't change what you're talking about when you talk to other people, you're going to end up getting hurt. Or you're going to end up with not a friend in the world, and then you're going to be at the mercy of the other races that are in, other gangs and everything else that are in here, you know? Because anytime anybody opened my mouth, they opened their mouth around me, well, let me tell you how it really is, you know? And I went about correcting them, you know? No matter what it was. I read a book one time called by a guy named Ernest Kurtz, and the title of the book he did his thesis on it was called Not God. And it was the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he wrote first history and then meaning and intent of Alcoholics Anonymous, man. And I was out there trying to be God, you know. And that's the whole title of his book, Not God. We come in AA and we find out that we're not God, you know, because we out there a drunk in his cups is God, Lord God Almighty in his head. You know, not consciously, but that's how we act. That's how I acted. So anyway, they told me to stop playing God, and I did a little bit. You know, I toned it down a little bit, and I got out, and this was, you know, when I got out of there, I got my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got stabbed in the eye in a bar fight, and first he rips me off, right, and then when I'm hanging around trying to get paid, you know, he stabbed me, you know. So this is just not fair either, you know. This is another bad break I got going here. So I took off. Only place I had left to go was my parents, and they said, okay, you can stay with us if you go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, okay, all right. And I remember going into AA and somebody gave me something to read, and they asked for reading. I started. I read it, and then somebody said, "Okay, now can we have someone?" Apparently, I'd read out of turn, right? somebody looked, you know, was like, okay, now can we have that writ? God, the newcomers, right? And that was all it took, man. I took off, you know. Boom, I'm to the bathroom, past the bathroom, and out in downtown drinking, you know. That quick, just that fast. I was like, oh, screw those people, you know. They don't understand me either. Yeah. And so I ended up sober for, I eventually sobered up for a little while in there, but it was not sobriety. You know, I just dried out for a little while because I was tired. You know, and I was a wreck. You know, my eyes healed up over the 25 years or whatever, 20, longer than that. 27, 25 years it's been, but at the time, you know, especially right after it happened, I mean, mothers would turn their children's heads away from me so that their child wouldn't be traumatized by the sight of my face, you know, and I finally looked on the outside how I felt on the inside, you know, finally matched, you know, it was awful. So I went to, it's hard to keep track of how many prisons I went to. But I ended up, I was out for maybe close to a year that time, and I ended up, I robbed a store in downtown Laguna the rumor is, if you go around town in Laguna, they'll tell you I robbed Benny the Bum's diner with a table knife, you know, with a butter knife, right? It wasn't a butter knife, right? But it doesn't matter. It was just pitiful. It was getting more and more pitiful as my drinking went, right? And half the restaurant could have gave you my name and full address and everything. And they're chasing me in circles around downtown Laguna, right? And I'm like, oh my God. And I finally got enough distance to jump in the car and get away. But, you know, I was caught down the street a little ways. And so I got another 7-year sentence. I went to... This time I went to Mule Creek Prison, right down the road from San Quentin. They just opened it up, and I was I was done, you know. I thought I was done, and God gave me the gift of sobriety. I'd been exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. The mustard seed had been planted, and I was done, you know. And I became done or whatever. I had that experience, and I didn't know what else to do. I'm going to church, right? And I'm going to church, and they're singing Amazing Grace, and it went to my head, because I had tried to believe somewhere along the way in a power greater than myself and God and Jesus and in anything but what I had going on. As they're singing that song, and I'd been batoned down to the ground by the police when they arrested me, as they should have. You know, I had almost broke my heel running down these stairs trying to get away, and I'm physically, mentally, and spiritually beat. Right, I'm done in. Right, and so I'm following after these guys in the jail, and I go to church and singing Amazing Grace, and I realize that, you know, I've been trying to believe with my head all along the way, and this whole thing of faith isn't from the head; it's from the heart. You know, it's a release of the analytical professor son crap that's been strangling me my whole life, and it's an acceptance of something that I can't see, touch, taste, or hear. You know, acceptance of power greater than myself that has its presence in my very being, and my being able to even consider it, man, that's where it's first living and breathing in me, you know, and then I get to see it in the rest of people in this world around it. And God gave me the gift of sobriety, you know, and then the bastard stepped back and see what I would do with it, right? Oh my God, I was done, right? But I was not done to the point where I thought I should ask one of you to sponsor me. So, how much time do I have left? I got to get sober here. I got to get sober here pretty fast, you know, man. I've got this old teacher. I mean, she's a wonderful woman named Muriel. She's from Santa Barbara, and she says if you she's from Boston, right? She's 30-something years sober. She said if you talk longer about your drunkalog than you do about your sobriety, you're not sober, right? And I'm like, oh, that's a rough judgment there, Muriel. I'm trying to let people identify. You're probably long identified, but I. I became, you know, I was leading born again meetings. And I was leading, you know, these Christian meetings. I was like the Bible study leader on a level 3 yard in California penitentiaries. And all these guys that knew that maniac that was in Soledad, you know, they'd come up to me and they go, David, what happened to you? You know, you used to be all right, man. Now, man, I don't even recognize you anymore. And I just tell them, man, I got tired, man. You know, if you want to think of it as a weakness or a failing, that's fine. But I changed my mind. I can't do it anymore. I can't. You know, and I was going, we had a meeting every other week. Every 2 weeks, we had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was my first exposure to the people of H&I. And I could draw you a picture of their faces, at least a couple of them. I could draw you, I can't tell you their names to save my life, but I can draw you a picture of at least two of them, and I can tell you some of the things they told me that stuck. You know, this one guy, I think his name was Charlie, but he was like 80, 98 something. I mean, he was just ancient to me. He was ancient, right? And he had 10 years of sobriety. He had 10 years of sobriety, and he was like a hobo drunk. You know, his whole career was hobo drunk, and just very low bottom. But when he got sober, he got an H&I, and he carried the message like nobody's business. When he died, he was out of Sacramento. When he died, because I saw him a week before he died, and he was coughing. He was coughing really, really bad. I was sitting across the room from him, and he looked up after a coughing spell, and I saw a scared little boy. You know, I saw the fear in his eyes. You know, he knew it was coming to the end, man. I didn't know how to, you know, go up and just give him a hug and tell him, I love you, man. You've made a difference in my life, man. You've made a difference in a world of people's lives. But he died, and that old hobo had 1,500 people at his funeral, you know. How many low bottom drunks like me would you know, or him, if he hadn't got to Alcoholics Anonymous, would have 1,500 people with tears in their eyes and thinking about what a good man he was at the end of his life. So that made a huge impression on me. The other one was not so nice to me. I was sitting there in a break at a meeting, and this woman came up. She said, you know, I was kind of feeling a little sorry for myself, and Here's the measure. I don't know what I was feeling sorry about myself for now. Okay, so it can't have been a big deal. She walks up and asks me, what's going on, Dave? You're kind of quiet, you know, crying. And she said, well, rather than commiserate, you know, or a little empathy or just, oh, I'll be okay, David, something. She said, well, did you ever think that maybe you shouldn't take yourself so damn seriously, you know? I was offended, to be honest. You know, I was like, man, I can, but I've never forgot that, you know, because I do that all the time. I take myself so damn seriously, man, and there's no need. And there really is no need, man. So I remember that, you know, and I was sober, and I ended up over in Tehachapi, and Santa Clarita Valley H&I came into Tehachapi at that time, man, and I don't remember the names, but I remember the people coming week after week, you know, month after month and year after year, and them trying to give me the message, which was the opposite of the message that I've been getting from the courts and the POs and the policemen and the jail officers and the prison guards. They tried to give me the opposite message. They tried to tell me that I was a worthwhile human being. They tried to tell me that there was hope for me in spite of myself. They tried to tell me that there was a whole program out here where I would fit in and I would be able to find somebody to work through the steps and change the human being that I had become, you know, or the animal that I had become. I already had a sponsor, okay? Myself. And I worked the steps as I saw fit, you know? And you know, I didn't change the man. I don't change. I'm going to drink again. The same man will drink again. You know, and I drank again. It took me a quick 2 months after parole. And I was picked up by this woman named Angie from L.A., I just saw her at the Orange County Convention. She's 49 years of sobriety, and almost the whole time she's been in AA, and she's 98-something-thousand years old, and she's just the life of the party, you know. I was picked up by her and several other H&I peoples, and my God, man. Angie, I remembered her because of what she used to always say at the end of every share. She would say, finally, I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. And she'd look me in the eye or someone in the eye when she said that. And she's sincere, man. She's sincere. You know, she believes that, and she believes in me. You know, so you guys made a big impression on me, but it just wasn't big enough. Yeah, it wasn't big enough. I'm a very slow learner, man. After I went out, you know, series of coincidences and bad breaks, and I ended up drinking, and I ended up on something that you know, they talk about the progression of an alcoholic, where he might go to his doctor and get a subscription for morphine. Well, all I had to do was go down the corner and meet Chewy down there, right? And I ended up on some really, really strong sedatives, man. And I was drinking, doing everything all through the way. You know, you got an alcoholic slash. I know this is meeting Alcoholics Anonymous, but you know you got other issues as well when you're shooting dope and you're mixing up the dope in Jack Daniels, because you got to have some alcohol in you too. You know, oh my God, I should be dead. You know, I should be dead, man. And I ended up robbing banks. You know, I robbed my dad's bank. You know, the professor's son robbed his professor dad's, where he has an account in. I robbed my dad's bank in downtown Laguna. And I went up on a spree all the way up to Oregon. You know, I went up to, it was in the middle of winter, and I went up to Portland, Oregon, so it could rain on me for 3 weeks. And I was living on the streets. I was living underneath bridges. And I was living in people's cars, or somebody might let me crash. Thousands of dollars in my pocket, man, and I'm living underneath bridges. You know, I was the most pitiful thing I could imagine. You know, I couldn't imagine anything worse, man. And the arresting officers, you know, they couldn't believe it. You know, they couldn't believe it. They'd never had anything. I was in Bend, Oregon, and they'd never had anything like me blow through their town. And you know, and I was so into self, and I was so critical that I ended up. You know, I'm saying all these things. You know, I'm saying, man, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I probably got AIDS. That's the last thing you want. You want to say you probably got AIDS in a little back hick town like Bend, Oregon, right? So by the time they got me to Portland, I'm in a paper white jumpsuit, and everything I own, including my glasses, were gone. They got me fully masked off, and I'm segregated from everybody. Now I'm not even a part of enough to lump in with the rest of the convicts and murderers and everything else that's in there. I've got to be completely apart. So I get a 151-month sentence. And my, you know, I'm 33, man. And at that time, man, I was like, man, I just want to die. You know, I want to die. I had $500 cash that I smuggled in there, and I won't tell you how. And I ended up not being able to find anything. I wanted to find something to take myself out, and I couldn't do it. You know, God was looking out for me even when I didn't believe in Him. Even when I could not look out for myself, I can look back on my life and see the finger of God all the way through, man. And they put me in Sheridan FCI, and I ended up finding out that the federal government is losing the war on drugs right in the place where they're supposed to have the very most control, inside their own penitentiaries, man. There was so much drugs, and there was so much drinking and pruno, and we're making white lightning and taking big jars of water to the yard. It's not water. It's, you know, it's 150-plus proof alcohol. And I burglarized the commissary, you know, in Sheridan, and I ended up getting, for punishment, they put me in the hole for a year and then shipped me to Lompoc, USP Lompoc Penitentiary. In USP Lompoc Penitentiary, man, the desire came back. You know, I woke up one day and I said, you know what, I'm going to ask these guys down the tier, man, because they're kind of quiet and they don't chase the drugs and the alcohol like the rest of y'all. I'm going to ask them if there's any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found there was 5 meetings a week. There was Lee Carroll, who's a 15-year member of the program with a badge, who's bringing. I mean, we heard the speaker last night came in and spoke to us. The speaker, Karen Garrison, Cliff Rhodes, Earl Hightower, just the full list of Pacific Group speakers and some more coming in to share to a group of 20 glum, solemn convicts, man, but who were finally starting to get the message, you know. But more than that, it was the people from the local areas. You know, it was the H&I people that were coming in. The guy doing the cups here at this conference. I can't even look at him. I can't even meet that. Every time I meet that man, I want to just break down and cry and hold him until it stops. His dad, this old guy named Jack, came for the whole 7 years I was sober in there. The whole 7 years. Every Friday, if the penitentiary was open for visitors, Jack was there sitting in his seat. And Jack, he wasn't a great speaker. He's like me. He wasn't a great speaker, but he did by his actions, which means so much more. It means so much more. And then Jack used to say, sometimes a man's got to stand still and feel the pain. And he told me that at a couple years sober while I was waking up from with just this ocean of sorrow inside me because I was starting to have to feel all the stuff that I had stuffed all these years. I was feeling, I didn't know human beings could feel so deeply. I certainly didn't know I could feel so deeply, you know. And that little kid that didn't think he had a conscience was coming alive, and everything that I didn't feel, I got to feel in early sobriety. I almost didn't make it. You know, I almost didn't make it, and I would not have made it if it wasn't for H&I people telling me this is normal. You know, this is normal. And what what Keith said last night, his sponsor told him, if you're going through hell, don't stop. You know? Oh my God. And I was hearing all these things. I was finally able to hear. You know, and you know, I started a tape meeting up there where we had this big box of tapes, circuit speaker tapes, man, and we'd sit around, drink coffee, and we'd listen to those tapes, and we'd laugh and cry with somebody that had no idea that they were listening to, you know, that they were being listened to years later by a group of guys in the middle of a spiritual awakening in the middle of the worst penitentiary on the West Coast. You have no idea about what one single action in Alcoholics Anonymous can make and the ripples of the pond principle on down the line. No idea. Me and my girlfriend Cindy, we donated a sewing. I'm a member of H&I, you know. I'm a member of North County H&I, and I'm a panel coordinator for the South Coast Hospital. It's the only place that'll let me in right now. But you know, and I carried two panels a month at that place, and me and Cindy donated a sewing machine. They'd asked for sewing machines. We had no idea why. She had a sewing machine. She donates it. The next H&I conference, we get introduced to Deputy Ray Guerrero of Los Angeles, Orange County jails, and Deputy Director, he found out who we were, that we were the people that donated the sewing machine, and he just starts coming out of his shoes, oh, sir, sir, and I'm looking around, at, who is this guy calling sir, right? It's me, right? And he tells me and my girl that you've no idea what happened. You've no idea what happened. We donated the sewing machine because we didn't need it, and H&I needed it. It's out of my hands. Yeah. The girls who were in the jails had taken that sewing machine that we donated, and they started showing trauma gear for the soldiers in Iraq. You know, and they sold all these trauma gear from people having their arms, legs, whatever, chopped off, and they needed specialty clothing. We were the only ones who donated a sewing machine. It was the only sewing machine they got, you know. But somehow news of that got out, and it really got out. It got put on the county news, KTLA or whatever, got put on the news down there, and all kind of donations started coming in, and they started sewing. I mean, they got money, they got clothing, material, more and more sewing machines, and it's just this big thing that these women have purpose and dignity, that while they're inside, they can do something with purpose and dignity in their life. I never would imagine this life. You know, I got asked to share once when I was in there, and it was 15-minute, right? Leader qualifies, 15-minute. We got an hour for the meeting. 47 minutes later, somebody starts yawning, it's my cellie in the back row, he's yawning, right? I'm like, oh, man, oh, my God, I looked at the watch, and I'm having that same experience here, but thank you for not yawning yet, man. I want to tell you, I don't even recognize the man that I see in the mirror anymore. It's the guy that did those things. You know, I walked into a blind woman's house. My grandma's next door neighbor was at the end of her life, and her, you know, she was alone. I was 18 years old. My grandmother wanted me to to see this lady. And she was so proud of her grandson. So I go over there and I go, yeah, she's blind, you know. And can I use your bathroom, ma'am? And I went into her room and I took her mementos of her whole life underneath my arm. And I walked out of her house right in front of her with her jewelry chest underneath my arm. And then I blocked the memory of that. About 5 years later, the first time I was in AA, when I got stabbed in a bar fight, my mom asked me, asked me something about it. And I said, what are you talking about? I would have never done so. And then it came crashing back. I shared what the program, the redemptive power of Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life. At the Sawdust Festival this year, my little artist bio, it's a pitch for Alcoholics Anonymous, man. Sorry, I'm not, it's not press, radio, and film, so I'm putting it out there. But the greatest part of the summer for me was I was taking a break and I was down at the beach watching the waves and this old, sad looking woman walks up and she's got her dog and she's watching the waves on the rail a little ways down from me, and I'm looking at her. She's just so sad looking. And I started playing with her dog. And then we started talking, and apparently her husband had just died a few months ago, and she was Hispanic, but she'd lived in Laguna a long time, and they had money and stuff. They weren't like migrant workers or something. And so she is not finding a place to fit in. I can identify with that, I talked to this woman for half hour, 45 minutes, and I speak a little Spanish, and we were talking in Spanish, and I was telling her about my experience in Mexico, and my experience, I told her my story, and she walked way up the hill with a little lighter step, she was smiling. Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about, I just want to clear the record. I want to clear the record of the things I've done in this world and make a difference for the good. And thanks to you good people and the people who support H&I, who saved my life, Curtis Larkin, Natalie Brown, just a host of people whose names I can never remember. But it's... And I'm a part of now, and I'm doing the deal, and I'm clean and sober, and I want to thank my girlfriend for listening to me time and time again, and that's all I got for today, man. I hope I didn't go over.